January argument. 99-1069, Rhonda Neff et al. Versus James Rosina. Arguing for the Neffs is Attorney Dean R. Brody. Mr. Brody, you may proceed.
Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court, I would like to say it is good to see you again, but usually this, in my experience, has not been all that enjoyable. The issue before us today is basically whether the insured, Mr. Chazelle, overcomes a presumption of prejudice to American Family Insurance in failing to provide notice as required by the American Family policy. The statutory provision, which is the crux of the law in this case, in addition to the case law, is section 632.26, subparagraph 2, which indicates that failure to give notice as required by the policy does not bar liability under the policy if the insurer was not prejudiced by the failure. But the risk of non-persuasion is upon the person claiming there was no prejudice. We argue under section 632.26 sub 2 that the insurer was not prejudiced in this case by a 23-month delay in notification post-accident. We base that on the fact that there was ample evidence on the record at the trial of this matter that a complete investigation of this accident was conducted by one of the defendant's insurers through a independent claim service, a Mr. Clarence Ayers, Cooley Claims Adjusting, who was retained to investigate this in the interest of a defendant, Anton Johnson, the owner of the business premises where this elevator, collapsed elevator, was located, and on behalf of West Central Insurance.
If that's your argument, and of course, I think American Family uses the argument that, look, this claims adjuster was not a person, let's say, he was not an expert in elevator accidents. He took, and you correct me, but he did not inspect or photograph all of the relevant areas. He conducted rather brief interviews. Wouldn't that in itself be, quote, prejudicial? Wouldn't that, in other words, his interests and American Family's interests were not, you know, parallel. They were competing interests. And as I understand it, he focused on the business relationship rather than, you know, what the cause of the accident or what the nature of the accident. And that seems to be the argument. What is your response to that portion?
My response to that, Your Honor, is in hindsight. I think that it is easy to pick apart any investigation that would have been done relative to this accident.
Let me add, then there was a change of business relationship. I think, if I read the facts correctly, that this business was sold, wasn't it? So the investigation, there was a, let's say, one attorney told his client not to talk to him, you know, to the investigators. But then there actually was a change in the business relationship here involving this building.
I think the change in the business relationship occurred, Your Honor, a while after the initial investigation was done. In addition, this particular business relationship that existed was an extremely loose one. David Chazelle, who was involved as basically a subcontractor of this individual, worked on a part-time basis. I believe that the record would indicate that the facts were well established as to what Mr. Chazelle's involvement was in this business within 6 months after this accident. It is stated that there were three recorded statements that were taken in this case. One of those recorded statements was stated to be 7 pages in length. It is single-spaced. There's a lot of information contained within it. That recorded statement is the recorded statement of David Chazelle that was taken by Mr. Ayers. Now, American Family states that and criticizes the investigation that was conducted. And in hindsight, that's very easy to do. I suppose any insurance company could say, but didn't you do this? Or we would have done this. And I believe that that was very appropriately pointed out by defense counsel representing American Family at the time of trial. However, I think what was missed was the fact that Mr. Ayers, having experience as an adjuster, as an investigator, a person who did delve into, I believe, many of the aspects of the business relationship between Mr. Chazelle and Mr. Johnson, did a full investigation of this claim. This is not a situation where we have any missing witnesses, where we have any evidence that is not able to be obtained because of the fact that it has been lost or misplaced. This particular elevator location where this accident occurred was under lock and key from the time that this accident occurred until the time that this litigation was pending. And so there was ample opportunity, even for American Family Insurance after the fact, to go to that premises and to do a further investigation. And the evidence, uncontroverted evidence in this case, is that there was absolutely no destruction, modification, or alteration of any of the evidence with the elevator that is involved here.
Mr. Rohde, in this particular case, you face a rebuttable presumption of prejudice. And so the standard of review seems to become quite important. What is your position in regard to the standard of review?
Your Honor, that is a very good question because I think that is somewhat unsettled. And I think the Court of Appeals pointed that out in their decision, and they did not come to a conclusion on that. They decided that they did not have to because their decision didn't depend upon that.
Well, let me ask you this. It's my understanding that if we followed the Court of Appeals decisions, that we would use a de novo standard. Is that correct?
I think, Your Honor, that could very well be argued that there is a de novo standard, and that is the application of the undisputed facts to the law, similar to a decision on summary judgment. However, if, as stated in Ehlers and the City of Edgerton, we are looking at the factual issues here and whether looking at a question of facts, that the standard then becomes the clearly erroneous standard, and that is if the judge's findings are not clearly erroneous, then the court would have to uphold those findings. But the problem that we have here is I think we may in fact get into a mixed question of fact and law. And the reason for that is if we look at all of the facts as a whole, I don't think that the record is extremely detailed with respect to the factual determinations that the judge made. I think that there are many facts that are contained within the record that would go to the issue of being disputed facts, mainly the facts concerning whether or not this was a full and proper investigation of this case. Whether the factual findings fulfill the legal standard of prejudice is a question of law. And that's stated in the Hinkfist case that is cited in the brief, and that also cites the Nadelson versus DILHR case, which is this court's 1980 decision. And so I think in this particular case, we may be dealing with a mixed question of fact and law, it is a de novo.
If we are, how should we approach it? What standard of review should we be giving then?
I think the court would review the trial court's findings of fact and determine whether or not the findings of fact that are stated on the record are clearly erroneous or not. That is the standard on the review of whether this is a questions of fact. But I think once you take the undisputed facts that are stated as a part of the trial court's decision and you apply that to the law in this case, and that is section 632.26 sub 2, to determine whether fitting those facts within the law of whether or not we have overcome the presumption of prejudice, that becomes a question of law. And I feel that as you look at all of the facts in this case, and as you look at the facts of this investigation, and as you look at the facts and you ask the question, well, how was American Family actually prejudiced in this case? Taking the facts within the context of the law, I think that becomes a de novo review of the law of 632.26 sub 2, as well as incorporating the case law.
Well, counsel, that's as to the issue of prejudice, which,
yes,
at least according to your brief, is the second issue, and which counsel for American Family says we shouldn't even reach. Putting aside the question of whether we should reach it or not, the first issue, which is it's interesting in terms of timeliness, whether Mr. Schiessel was he timely in notifying the insurance company? What's the standard of review there? And what findings, if any, did the trial court make? And what is the standard of our review?
The trial court found that Mr. Schiessel did not make timely notice as a matter of law in this case. He stated that based upon the facts, that we automatically went into the provisions of Section 632.26 sub 2 because we did not fulfill the requirements of Section 631.81, which is that notification within a reasonable time or within 1 year when the insurance contract calls for it. So the judge found as a matter of law that we didn't meet that.
631, what is it?
0.81.
81, right. So what do you think is the standard of review? Is that a mixed question of fact and law also?
I think under the case law that is a question of fact.
And you're bound by the trial court's finding?
Unless it is clearly erroneous.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's clearly erroneous?
Your Honor, I think there could be an argument made that it is. I would not say that I would not stand before you and say that particular argument is anywhere near as strong as the argument as to 632.26 sub 2. It is clear that Mr. Schiessel did not provide notification to American Family until 23 months after this incident occurred. However, I think it's also important to look in a very detailed analysis of what the facts of the situation were. And that is, Mr. Schiessel was a very unsophisticated individual. This incident occurred in an elevator on a business premises where he worked part-time. He did not have management or ownership or rental of this property. He had no maintenance responsibilities with the elevator. The insurance policy that we're looking at was a renter's insurance policy that was held by his wife on other premises.
I'll interrupt for just a minute. The issue of prejudice has nothing to do with the issue of timeliness of Mr. Schiessel, correct? I mean, we could even find that the American Family was prejudiced, but if we found that Mr. Schiessel timely notified them...
Yes, Your Honor, and that's what 631.81 speaks to. Mm-hmm. And that's that one-year provision, 1 year after as soon as the policy calls for it. But if you were to find that was not met, as the trial court judge did, then you go to 632.26.
Sorry to interrupt you. What are some of the other facts as to what you believe made this notice timely as opposed to untimely?
Mr. Schiessel was, first of all, not conducting business at the time this incident occurred. Two of his friends were with him. He said, hey, let me show you the second floor of this chicken coop and look at what we got up there, some appliances and such. They were good friends. They had known each other for a while, as were these people good friends with the owner of TJ Duck's business. Mr. Schiessel took them up to the second floor. Just as about they got there to the second floor, the elevator cable broke. Mr. Schiessel considered himself a victim of this accident, not a participant in any type of negligent behavior. And one of the reasons, as he stated on the record, was that he was considered himself to be in the same situation as the Neffs were. He sustained injury as a result of the elevator collapse. He wasn't conducting business at the time. He had no ownership or maintenance or control over the elevator. And it was simply an event which he didn't understand why he would be the subject of any potential action. He considered himself an injured victim.
Mr. Rohde, is it significant at all that Mr. Schiessel or Schiessel had been told by Johnson and also by, is it Prezina?
Yes.
That only those two and Schiessel were to go to the second floor, that nobody else belonged on that second floor?
Your Honor, I think that is a significant fact. And I think that would probably be, that is a fact that is argued by American Family, I think, as being something that would point to Mr. Chazelle having had some sort of reason to believe that he may have been involved or a participant in this incident. And that's where I think the strongest argument is as to the application of 631.81 and the fact that he should have notified within 1 year of the time called for in the policy, which is, quote, promptly notify the insurer of an accident or an occurrence.
One of my concerns about this case, and I'm not sure it's well-founded, but is its ramifications. I can think of a myriad of examples when there would be notice not given until 23 months later. A myriad of examples where people think of themselves as kind of innocent participants, as your client thinks of himself as a victim. You can think of a multiple rear-end accident where one of the middle people, you know, just gets pushed from the back and then pushes into the front, you know, on a bunch of ice. Or you can think of anything from a products case where someone, you know, they're looking for a deep pocket, you know, so finally after the case is started, two and a half years later, you bring the person who touched the widget someplace along the way, or a wet basement case where you're looking for a bunch of people to contribute to a settlement, and so, you know, anyone that breathed upon the wet basement is brought in 2 years later. So now all of those, or a few of those, are exaggeration for emphasis, but not too much of an exaggeration. My point is there are lots of kinds of causes of action where people just happened in their mind to be there. And after the lawsuit is started, 2 years later, they find themselves being brought in because they happened to be there. What kind of ramification does this decision have for those parentheses, innocent victims or innocent bystander hyphen defendant situations? Anything?
Well, I think it could have tremendous ramification, and I think that each one of the cases, as is stated in the case law, needs to be taken on its own facts. It is not merely the passage of time that determines whether or not, and that's the RTE case, it's not merely the passage of time that determines whether or not there is reasonable notice in a case, but it's all the facts and circumstances of the case. And I would point to what I think is another case that is on point that's cited in the briefs, and that is the Garcia case. In that particular case, there was a stepfather of a young girl who went to a park to pick her up, and she was going to go along shopping. He was sitting on the opposite side of the road, and he motioned her across the road to come into the truck. The girl entered the street and was struck by another car driving down the road. That individual didn't notify his insurance company of that situation. 2 years and 9 months after the incident occurred, a claim was brought against the stepfather for the motioning of the child across the street. Nearly 3 years. In that particular case, the court held that you have to look at the facts and circumstances of the case, and in this case, did that individual have reason to believe or know that he was a participant or potentially a cause in this particular accident? And I think that's very similar, in essence, to what we're looking at here. What is the reasonableness? What are the facts, and then does that individual have a reason to know or to believe that they may wind up as a defendant in a lawsuit? And in this case, it was very obvious that Mr. Chazelle felt himself to be a victim, and that goes as to this first statutory section, 631.81, that we're talking about.
Now, your client, though, did not give notice until, what, 6 months after he was named defendant?
The first investigation that was done on the case was about 6 months after, I'm sorry, Your Honor, misunderstood the question. My client gave notice, I think, within several, it was within several weeks after his deposition was taken, but that would have been several months after he was named as a defendant. But at that point in time, American Family, we still had the situation where he was named individually. His deposition was taken. He was alerted to the fact that he may have coverage at that time through, I believe, the questioning of the attorneys present. And then shortly after the time of his deposition, American Family was notified, and American Family was brought in.
Help me with these facts. Initially, he was considered an employee of Johnson, or that was being pursued, and so what's Johnson's carrier, Great Western or something like that? And then didn't Great Western provide him an attorney?
Yes.
On that, to defend him, reserving rights on the issue whether or not he was actually an employee.
Yes.
So he had an attorney supplied through Great Western. There's a determination that he's not an employee, therefore Great Western no longer had a duty of coverage. He kept the same attorney, and then American Family was notified. Help me with that. What are the right facts?
Mr. Chazelle was added to this lawsuit on February 27th of 1998. That was the amended complaint. On March 16th of 1998, Attorney Nodler was retained as defense attorney for West Central, Mr. Johnson's insurance company, on the merits. And then after that point in time, on May 4th of 1998, there was the deposition of Mr. Chazelle, and Attorney Nodler was present. Then we filed a second amended complaint on June 2nd of 1998, adding American Family after the deposition of Mr. Chazelle. And that's when the notification of American Family occurred. There was initially a deposition scheduled of Mr. Chazelle, but it was found out that he was not represented, so that was delayed for a significant
period of
time.
So he had an attorney, and initially it was under the theory that he was an employee, so he would have been his employer's insurance company. Then it was determined that maybe he might have some individual exposure and not be, although defended under reservation of rights, that no longer be provided any kind of defense or coverage.
It was determined finally by the trial court that he was not an employee, but that he was in fact an independent contractor or something else. And so there was not coverage by the employer's insurance, West Central Insurance, the employer of TJ Docs. I think, Your Honors, getting back to the specific facts of this case, again, I think crucial to this case is 632.26 sub 2, because American Family criticizes the quality and the quantity of information it received as a result of another defendant's investigation of the facts and circumstances of this accident.
Well, they did only get, what was it, the adjuster, which I used to be one in a former life, had only like 2 years training that investigated this, and they used to, but it seems to me perfectly reasonable for American Family to say, hey, we're very much prejudiced because we would have sent out a seasoned, trained adjuster and done measurements and, you know, done all the kind of things that a very experienced adjuster would do.
And, Your Honor, they could have done that after they were brought into the suit because nothing had changed. The elevator where the location of this accident occurred, the building where it occurred, was under lock and key. Nothing, the evidence indicates nothing had been modified. Nothing had been changed. This is not a case of missing witnesses or missing evidence, as I stated earlier. This is a case where all these things are fixed in time. This is not a case where all of a sudden we have a witness who has moved to Europe that a deposition cannot be obtained. Not a case where a witness has died or disappeared. All of the witnesses are intact. The location of this accident is intact. That is where we get to the issue of the bald assertions that somehow we're prejudiced because we couldn't ask this question or this question or this question. Our assertion is that the questions that are germane to their defense of this case were asked. And our assertion is that it wouldn't matter if they investigated that case 2 years after the fact, because they would have found the same facts to be true, unless you accept the argument that in some way, shape, or form, once they had attorneys retained, the facts changed. And I would hope that that would not be the case.
Could you explain something that I don't quite understand? You represent the NEPs, is that right?
Correct.
Does anyone represent Mr. Schiesel?
Mr. Attorney Nogler represented him on the merits of the case, not as to coverage.
Why isn't he here?
I don't know. I'm sure there's a good reason, but I don't know.
He could be held personally liable, could he not?
I don't know.
Who filed the petition for a review? You did.
I did. See that I have a red light.
You want to sit down, huh?
Now, can she still be liable to you or your client personally?
Yes.
And he was given notice of the of this review?
I believe so.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Neff. We have several minutes, 5 minutes of rebuttal. Ms. Wickstrom, representing the American Family.
Good morning. May it please the court, as you can imagine, from the very beginning, American Family has had a completely different perspective on this case than the Neffs or anyone else involved in this incident. American Family first received notice of this accident on June 10, 1998. The Neffs, who were present, obviously received notice on the day of the accident. Their attorney received notice within 2 weeks after the accident, and so the plaintiffs have had an ample opportunity to do whatever investigation they want to do. And at this point, there's no evidence in the record of what investigation they have done, but they have had that opportunity. The other named defendants, who incidentally are the only other witnesses to this, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Perzina, as well as Mr. Schiesel, American Families Insured, also knew about the accident right away. The insurance companies for Mr. Johnson and Mr. Perzina had the opportunity, because they were notified relatively quickly, to do whatever investigation they wanted to from their perspectives. And both of those insurance companies have raised coverage issues which have been tried in front of the court, the trial court. So those insurance companies came into this with a very different perspective on the case than did American Family, but they had the opportunity to investigate. American Family did not. When American Family became involved in this case, they learned about it for the first time through service of the summons and complaint. They did not learn about it through Mr. Schiesel. When American Family became involved, every person who was a potential witness was represented by counsel. So there was no opportunity to contact anybody individually and just have a normal conversation with them, a normal interview, as you would in the course of a normal investigation. The owner of the building where this incident occurred was also represented by counsel. That would be Mr. Perzina. Because he was represented by counsel, American Family couldn't just go up to him and say, hey, we'd like to take a look at this building, we'd like to take a look at the elevator. Arrangements would have to be made through the attorney, supervised by the attorney through the regular course of discovery.
What difference would that make? You got access to the building. Your opposing counsel said nothing had changed. This has been all locked up. So what's missing?
We don't know, and that's the problem. As an insurance company, not having had a chance to be there at the beginning, we can't prove to you what is or is not missing. But from our perspective, the ability to take a look at the building isn't the key to the prejudice that American Family is facing. Because, yes, the building is still there. The elevator is still there. People say it hasn't changed. We have no choice but to accept it at this point. The prejudice comes in that some of the other things that should have been investigated, that would have been investigated if American Family had the chance to do it, were not investigated. For example, American Family has exclusions in its policy. One of the exclusions is for business operations, and there are exceptions to that exclusion. There was absolutely no investigation done into that particular issue by Mr. Ayers, who did the investigation on behalf of West Central. Mr. Ayers was told to do an investigation based on West Central's policy and the liability of its insureds. West Central had a policy where there was an exclusion based on whether Mr. Chazelle was an employee of Mr. Johnson. The American Family exclusion doesn't refer to employees. It doesn't matter if he's an employee, if it's his own business, if he's just doing something for financial gain. It's a completely different exclusion.
Why does the passage of time prejudice you? What has changed?
People have forgotten. Let me give you a few examples of things people have forgotten. By the time of his deposition and the time of the trial, Mr. Chazelle wasn't able to tell us accurately how many hours per week he had worked. He gave several different answers on that. He gave several different answers on what he was paid. Neither he nor Mr. Johnson was able to remember accurately how many appliances had been repaired or sold in the course of this business. Things that would help us determine exactly what kind of business this was what Mr. Chazelle was doing at the time of this accident a business pursuit, none of those things were explored. And because they don't remember those things now, American Family has suffered a tangible prejudice.
Is that tantamount to asking for a per se rule that 2.5 years passage of time, one can always infer that memories will be diminished, some greatly, some not so greatly, and so that anytime there's 2.5 years or 2 years or whatever the period of time might be, there's prejudice?
Not at all. I think the presumption of prejudice was based on the understanding that when time passes, people often do forget things. I remember clearly what I did yesterday, but don't quote me on what I did last Tuesday. And I think that's a very common problem that people have. And hence, this court has developed the presumption of prejudice, which recognizes that at a certain point, because memories are bad, after a year, it's better to put the burden of that on the people, such as the insured, who could have notified the insurance company and avoided any sort of prejudice whatsoever. So I don't think there's a separate request for an automatic presumption, because this court has applied the presumption of prejudice in a variety of different lengths of time.
Counsel, you have said that you are prejudiced not by the timeliness, but by people have forgotten. How many hours per week were worked, you're saying, what he was paid, how many appliances were repaired. Okay. What evidence would your opposing counsel have to put on to rebut the prejudice?
I think if Mr. Rohde could find some business records, which unfortunately there aren't, or anything that would provide us with information concerning the business so that we would be able to analyze whether the business exclusion truly applied, that type of thing would be available. If that type of thing were available, then the presumption of prejudice could be overcome. But in this case, not only do we have the presumption of prejudice based on the passage of time, but there's actually proof that some things are gone from people's memories.
Ms. Wexstrom, was your client deposed before American Family got involved in this case?
Yes.
Was he deposed more than once? I wasn't clear when I looked at the facts if there was more than one deposition of him.
He's been deposed, I believe, 3 times. He was deposed initially before American Family became involved in the case, and he was deposed either once or twice thereafter as part of the coverage dispute.
Is there a question as to whether or not he was represented by counsel at the first deposition?
No, there is not. He was represented by Attorney Nogler. He was subpoenaed to a deposition in December before he had an attorney. And the attorneys who were involved at that point said, we're not going to go through with the deposition. You can sit here and listen to what we're asking the other people. But until you get yourself an attorney, we will hold off on questioning you.
So they didn't go ahead with the deposition and gave him a chance to get counsel?
Right. And then counsel was subsequently appointed by West Central.
Counsel, I have not read the amended complaint. What is the theory of liability for Mr. Chazelle?
The amended complaint basically says is a negligence complaint.
How is it negligent?
I'm assuming what the it's a broadly pled complaint, as I recall. And I believe the issue of negligence is whether Mr. Chazelle should have allowed the Neffs into the elevator and into the second floor of the chicken coop, given the fact that he had been specifically told not to do that.
Now, how were you prejudiced in defending that particular claim?
Well, the defense on the merits is of that claim is one thing. The defense of the coverage issues or the prosecution of the coverage issues is a completely different thing. And our prejudice lies primarily in the defense of the coverage issues. Although, as to the defense on the merits, we have the problem that because of the passage of time and because memories have faded, there are certain things that we may never be able to find out. And our problem, of course, is that because we'll never be able to find out what they are, we can't point them out to the trial court or to any of you.
Counsel, I'd like to direct your attention to the first issue, which you say is not properly before us, and obviously I would assume you're going to get into that. But assuming it's before us, because you're not going to get into it because you say it wasn't raised below. But on the question of timeliness, Mr. Chazelle claims that he didn't report it right away because he saw himself as a victim. Okay. But he, somewhere in the record I read that that the policy under which he is seeking coverage is a renter's insurance policy. Is that policy a part of the record?
Yes.
Okay. Where in that policy, if you know, is the language that I mean, when I think of this as an everyday person, I can sympathize somewhat with Mr. Chazelle. I wouldn't think that a renter's insurance policy is going to cover me in an accident, number one, that I'm not even think I'm not going to get involved in, that I'm a victim, but also, even if I was, my renter's insurance is for something else. What is it that, in that policy, that provides coverage here? And where is it?
I think there's a broad provision of coverage, as you would find in a homeowner's policy.
Of liability coverage, huh?
Right, of liability coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the coverage would be should this court reverse what the trial court has decided.
Okay, well, what do you say to my concern? I mean, I can think of many situations, that, not many, but a few that I've been involved in, that it took a while for me to realize that I probably had coverage and under some policy that really didn't seem to be related to the incident.
Well, I think this court has addressed that issue before because there have been other cases where people have come before this court to say, gee, we had no clue that there was going to be coverage under this policy. And what the court has said, I think, answers your question, and that is, we don't want an insured deciding whether there's coverage or not. We don't want an insured to be forced to read through the technical language of an insurance policy and say yes or no, somebody's, this is covered, that's not covered. The goal is to have an insured make the report to an agent, make the report to an insurance company that there's been an incident that may be covered, and then to allow the insurance company to do an investigation and determine whether there is or is not coverage. I think there is enough information in the media these days about various types of lawsuits to make people aware of the fact that there is coverage in a lot of places for a lot of things in homeowners' policies. For example, in the northern part of Wisconsin, pretty much annually, someone gets shot in a deer hunting accident. And pretty much every year, there's an article in a newspaper about the shooter and his homeowner's insurer being involved in a lawsuit, or the shooter and his automobile insurer being involved in a lawsuit. And I think that's pervasive enough that it would trigger in the minds of most people that if you have an insurance policy, you may have coverage, you may not. But it's certainly worth a call to your agent. And what American Families Policy required was notification to the company or an agent. If Mr. Chazelle, who asked his wife to get the coverage, knew the coverage was in effect on the day of the accident, knew where she got it, if he had just called the agent and said, here's the scoop, we wouldn't be here today.
Okay. What is the standard of review on both issues?
I think the standard of review is that this is a factual question. Both questions are factual questions, and I think it should be reviewed by the clearly erroneous standard. And I base that on a couple of things, one of which is the court's decisions in, for example, City of Edgerton and some of the other cases that we've cited in the briefs, and also the wording of the statutes, 632.26, which deals with notice provisions. Sub 2 provides that the risk of non-persuasion is on the person claiming there was no prejudice. I think that gives us the clue to what the legislature was intending. The legislature is intending us to look at this as a factual question. Who has persuaded whom, whether there is prejudice? And so I would say on both issues, based on previous case law and on the wording of the statute, that this is a circumstance where the clearly erroneous standard applies.
Could I follow up just an established line of questioning? When is it that American Family believes that Mr. Chazelle should have informed you?
Mr. Chazelle was capable of informing the agent or American Family immediately. And it's our position that he should have done so, the language is promptly, so within a few days or weeks at very least. Mr. Chazelle had the physical ability to make the report. Although he was injured, his injury was fairly minor. He continued to work at his normal job and at TJ Docks. So he didn't have any physical incapacity that would prevent him from making the report. And there was absolutely no claim that there was anything that prevented him from reporting this as soon as possible. And in addition to that, he knew that he had been involved in an incident. The test that this court has set out for when someone needs to make a report is when a reasonable person would think that they were involved in an accident or incident. It doesn't necessarily say that they will definitely be held liable for it, but they've been an integral part in an incident. And in this case, Mr. Chazelle had been told when this building was rented that this was private property and that only Mr. Chazelle, Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Prezina were allowed into the second floor of the chicken coop. That was made abundantly clear. There's absolutely no dispute about that. He was also told that Mr. Prezina wanted to have that rule so that the chicken coop would remain a private area. He was told that he wasn't to have anybody around the appliances for anything other than business purposes. So he took the Neffs into the second floor of the chicken coop, knowing that he had been given these instructions that he was violating, and knowing that he was taking them up there just out of curiosity. They weren't looking for appliances. They weren't looking for appliance parts. According to Mr. Chazelle's story, there's absolutely no reason to have them anywhere near that chicken coop.
Counsel? Let me look at it at a little different lens, kind of follow up what Justice Babbage was doing. Here's a guy who was in an elevator. He didn't make the elevator. He didn't maintain the elevator. He's in the elevator. It crashes. Someone gets injured. He's not intending to make a claim against his insurance company, so he doesn't contact an insurance company, and he certainly doesn't contact his renter's insurance company on that day. That seems reasonable to me, that this guy who thinks he's not responsible for maintaining or in any way being involved in an elevator crashing, except being a victim, not contact his renter's insurance that day of the accident. But you disagree with that, huh?
I do disagree with that, yes. The concessions that Mr. Chazelle made in his conversations with Investigator Ayers within 6 months after the accident, as well as at trial, that I think give us the answer to that. He told Mr. Johnson, and freely admits that he told Mr. Johnson, that this was his fault because he wasn't supposed to have anybody up there. He told that to Mr. Ayers several times. He blamed himself for this accident.
Well, but that being the psychological or a conclusional law, he certainly can't be losing a case on that basis.
I mean, well, I guess I'm trying to address the question of why he should have been prompted to talk to an insurance agent, and the answer is he knew he had done something wrong.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to focus on in conjunction with that is, so it's the insurance company's position that if he would have notified them the day after the accident, it would have been untimely.
No, not at all.
Okay, that's not. I'm going to lead you because I want to know. A week after the accident, he's untimely. He's untimely a week after the accident. Untimely in contacting his insurer, his renter's insurance. You know, again, he testified in his deposition that's in the appendix, just like Justice Babbage said. You know, I knew she had the policy, but I didn't think, what does this have to do with renter's insurance, my renter's insurance? So, is it a week after he would have been untimely?
Probably not. Well, the case.
When would he, I'm sorry, but my point, when would he, I'm going to lead you all the way, so rather than taking the time, when would he have been untimely? 5 months after the injury?
I don't know that we can say a particular date in this case because we don't know exactly when some of the information that we needed started to vanish.
And that is the exact point that I'm getting to, because you're saying with time, memories fade. And let's say he notified you within 5 months of the accident, and his testimony 5 months at the accident is still, as you're suggesting. I don't know the exact number of things that were repaired that week or the week before or the week before. Then you would be prejudiced at 5 months, is that right?
Potentially. But at that point, we might be able to get different information from Mr. Johnson, who might have had a better memory, or from Mr. Prezina, whose memory might not have been a problem. The problem we have in trying to prove prejudice is that we can't look back and say, in hindsight, at such and such a time, so-and-so's memory would have been fine, because we don't know that. We were denied the opportunity to find out what people remembered when. Because memories fade, because evidence gets lost, it's important to be able to get in and do an investigation as fast as possible. And in this case, it was a 2-year delay before we were able to do. hands were tied by the legal system. I think the reality is that if there had been notice within a year after the accident, we probably wouldn't be standing here. The burden on American Family would be very different. And I think the odds of there having been prejudice to American Family are much less. But it's not something that we can...
I don't understand that. Why? What's the difference of the year? If this had been done in a year rather than 2 years, could you explain that more, please?
Sure. Memories fade with the passage of additional time. And I think as a practical matter, there are things that would have been remembered in 1 year, in 6 months, that weren't going to be remembered in 2 years.
What if I'm brought in on a cross-claim 4 years after the incident in any lawsuit, and I notify my renter's insurance company? Then what do you do?
I think then you need to look at the other facts of the case. On its face, it appears that that's a case where the insurance company is going to be prejudiced. But then you need to look at what the incident was and what you knew. Were there things there that met the standard that's previously been set by this court so that a reasonable person would have to expect that he or she had been involved in an incident which might be covered? And that's really all that has to happen before the obligation to give notice to the insurance company is triggered.
It seems to me that it's quite clear that when he's named as a defendant, he might very well figure he's got liability and that he better check to see if he's got any coverage somewhere. I mean, that's your point. You should check your policies to see if you have coverage.
Right.
So is 6 months too long? I mean, if I, for the moment, assume that's the time he should have started giving notice, 6 months too long? Is that beyond the reasonable time period?
It depends on the facts of the case.
Well, let's take these facts.
The problem is we don't know. Mr. Ayers did an investigation, but he did a very limited investigation. He didn't ask any questions regarding American Family's business exclusion. And so we don't know whether those facts could have been gathered at that point or not.
The burden of going forward with the evidence to show prejudice is yours, right?
In the first year, yes. After the first year, then the presumption of prejudice changes things. And the burden of non-persuasion is upon Mr. Chazelle or the NEFs as the parties opposing American Family's position.
And who has the burden of going forward with the evidence?
That is not clearly stated. I think it's a logical conclusion that the person who has the burden, the risk of non-persuasion, has some burden of going forward with producing enough evidence.
So your position then is that the insured here has the burden of going forward with evidence showing that you are non-prejudiced and has the risk of non-persuasion?
Yes, given the fact that he waited for more than a year and American Family is entitled to the presumption of prejudice at that point.
I'm looking at the annotation after the statute, sub 2, and I can't even see what case it's referring to, but in maybe I need new glasses because I can't see it, but it says the burden of going forward, and this is describing sub 2, the burden of going forward with the evidence and the burden of persuading the trier of fact, this suggested to me anyway when I was reading it yesterday that under sub 2 the insurance company still had the burden of going forward. Do you think that's not correct?
Well, I don't think that's been conclusively determined by any appellate court, but my reading of the statute would be that because it is a risk of non-persuasion placed on the insured and anyone else who opposes the position of the insurance company at that point, then the burden of going forward with sufficient evidence to establish the presumption of prejudice should be overcome is upon the people who want to to make that point. You have to persuade the trier of fact on that point.
I mean, the comment says, indeed, since the insurer will have the best, parentheses, or the only accessed information about prejudice, it may be quite unfair to put the burden of going forward on the claimant. If you haven't read that, then it's probably unfair to you to be asking you about this in such a vague way, but I read that and was concerned about that yesterday. Yeah.
No, I have read it, and I have it here. I think that is in contrast to some of the language in the commentary on under section 631.81, which talks about the one-year time period. It talks about the prejudice that is imposed on an insurer because of delay. It says, in part, the situation is different in accident insurance, where the insurer has a clear interest in investigating the circumstances of the injury while the evidence is available. In many cases, 20 days may be too long a delay to start a meaningful investigation. This is especially true in liability insurance, where it is of vital importance for the insurer to be able to investigate the third person's claim quickly. I think what these two comments illustrate is the need to balance out the prejudice to the insurer because of time and the inability of the insurer to prove what is or is not out there or what would or would not have been out there with the same dilemma that the insured has.
What comment are you reading? I've got, I see with the one that Justice Bradley is looking at, and that's the one I was referring to, and that's where you don't give notice within the time required by the policy, right? What was the time required in this policy?
The time requirement was promptly, to give prompt notice, so it wasn't a specific number of days.
All right. And under 81, that's where you have the 1 year.
Right, and that was the comment that I was reading from, Your Honor. It's at the end of the first long paragraph of commentary under concerning subsection 1.
Could I ask, the trial judge found that Mr. Schizella was not an employee of Anthony Johnson. Was someone contending that he was an employee of Anthony Johnson?
There was a contest about that between one of the insurers and Mr. Chazelle and the Neffs, because I believe it was West Central who had an exclusion in its policy so that there would be no coverage if Mr. Chazelle was an employee. So when the trial court found that Mr. Chazelle was not an employee, then there was no coverage under the West Central policy. But that was a different issue, although it was tried simultaneously from the issues of coverage relating to American Family, because we have a business pursuits exclusion that's very differently phrased.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is, did Mr. Chazelle think he had coverage under somebody else's policy?
I don't know how directly he was asked that question. He did testify that he had talked with Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Johnson said he had business insurance. And that, from my memory, is the only testimony that might be able to answer your question.
Okay.
He also testified at about the same time that he did know he had insurance through American Family because he'd asked his wife to get it.
The accident is in July 1996, and I believe you just said that American Family wasn't informed until June 10th, 1998. There was some period of time, if I understand the facts, when Mr. Chazelle had an attorney. Is that right?
That's right.
How come the attorney didn't say, you better get to American Family?
I don't know. I think eventually the attorney did say that based on some of the information that the attorney mentioned at the beginning of the coverage trial. And it was his understanding, his impression, that Mr. Chazelle was going to do that. If Mr. Chazelle did it, it was after American Family received the summons and complaint.
Following up on Justice Prosser, if the trial court found that Mr. Chazelle was not an employee, which seems to me anyway that it would be reasonable for Mr. Chazelle at the time of the accident to believe that he was not an employee.
Now, that may be a big assumption, but assuming that Mr. Chazelle believed he was not an employee, why in the world would he, why would he think that somehow he is liable?
He would think that he's liable because he knew he had done something wrong in taking people who weren't supposed to be in the elevator and in the chicken coop into it at a time when there was an accident.
Gotcha.
Chief?
Yes. If you have the burden of going forward under 632.26 sub 2, have you met that burden?
I believe we have. By bringing up evidence concerning the things related to the business exclusion, which have not been, which have been forgotten, evidence that we might have been able to weed through to find out whether or not the business exclusion does in fact apply. At the trial, the trial court said, you didn't prove that the business exclusion applies. And so we lost on that point. We may have had a different outcome if the parties involved had remembered, had been questioned about those issues at a time when their memories were fresh.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Rohde.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, how did you rebut that if they had the burden of going forward and if they established what your opposing counsel has indicated? Have you rebutted that? Does the record so reflect? What's your argument?
Have we rebutted the presumption? Yes, Your Honor, I think we have. We had a strong record at the trial court based upon 28 pages of trial transcript testimony of Clarence Ayers, who investigated this accident within 6 months. Again, this all gets back to looking in hindsight, American Family stating, well, because he only had 2.5 years of experience, because he didn't ask certain questions, we had to be prejudiced. Because otherwise, you know, we would have done this, 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 and the other thing. The problem is I think that argument fails because I have to ask the specific question, what evidence are you missing? And what difference does it make?
Well, she did answer that. She said the business exception to the insurance policy.
The trial judge held that the business exclusion did apply in this case. However, there was an exception under the business exclusion which excluded not ordinarily pursued or non-ordinarily pursued business-type matters. In other words, the judge found that the business exclusion did apply, but there was an exclusion within the business exclusion, and I don't have the exact wording here, but it was a non-ordinarily engaged in business activity. And the judge found that although Mr. Chazelle was on business premises and this was within the business exclusion, he wasn't conducting business at the time. And I think from all of the facts, there were no facts presented at the time of trial of this matter and by the way, that issue of whether this was within the business exclusion is not being contested. What would be contested in the end is whether it was a non-ordinarily business activity. But the thing is, there are no facts that were presented at trial that would indicate that there was information that was not obtained going specifically to that issue. In this case, Mr. Chazelle was not engaged in specifically conducting business at the time this occurred. The facts of how this accident occurred and what happened were clearly asked by Mr. Ayers, and in the 7-page transcribed statement through Mr. Chazelle, I can't imagine how any additional questions would have been asked that would have indicated what else he was doing at the time.
Well, how about questions like, how many items were repaired? How many hours did you work that week? Is that indicative of the number of hours you worked in the last month? When did you start employment? Questions like that.
I think it's completely irrelevant to the issue of whether or not American Family can maintain the defense on whether this was a non-ordinarily business activity he was engaged in at the time. I will give them the fact that Mr. Chazelle may have repaired a certain number of appliances. There may be questions as to exactly what he was paid, but that's completely irrelevant to the issues before the court because They got their business exclusion ruling through the trial court. But within that, there was the exception of a non-ordinarily business pursuit, and that's what Mr. Chazelle was engaged in at the time. That doesn't go to the facts of how much he was making or what necessarily his business relationship was. It's very clear from the facts and through the statement that Mr. Ayers took that Mr. Chazelle was not an owner of this business, that he was basically subcontracted, that he was part-time, that this was basically a hobby that just barely crossed the line of a part-time business. This was conducted in a pole shed in a chicken coop.
Well,
these are used appliances.
Well, to establish a non-ordinary business pursuit, I mean, what are you doing? How much are you doing it? What do you get paid? Aren't those all indicia of establishing that?
I think the facts were very clearly established at the trial of this matter, Your Honor, what exactly Mr. Chazelle was doing at the time this incident occurred. And that goes to the non-ordinarily pursued business activity. And I think that all of the facts were very clearly disclosed. Now, if in fact facts were missing on that, or if there was a witness that was material that was missing where they couldn't obtain that information, then I think that would help their argument that they were prejudiced in this case. But Mr. Ayers clearly testified that he obtained statements from all of these individuals, and we know exactly what was going on. There isn't a shortage of facts as to the time when this incident occurred. What was Mr. Chazelle doing? Well, he was taking a couple of friends up to look at the second floor of the chicken coop. Were they interested in buying anything? Were they looking at anything? Was this? Absolutely not. In fact, Rhonda Neff didn't even want to go up to the second floor of the chicken coop, but she went up because she wanted to hurry up and get her husband out of there. So, and they were good friends. This was not a business transaction that was occurring at this time. And that's the way the trial judge ruled in this case. And the other thing is, there were no facts put into evidence by American Family during the course of this trial that would refute any of the facts that we established at trial.
Chief?
Justice Brasser.
If the court were to rule in your favor, Mr. Rohde, how would we be assured that we wouldn't be encouraging just lackadaisical reporting by potential claimants? I mean, how would we be assured that we wouldn't be just completely undoing the statute?
Your Honor, every case has its own facts. This is a strange set of facts and circumstances. I think these particular facts lend themselves to the court being able to say that this was an individual who was on a business premises. This was renter's insurance. It was in the name of his wife. He initially was told that Mr. Johnson had business insurance. This was a very unsophisticated individual. And the bottom line is when we get down to the issue of prejudice, we have to look at how was the insurance company prejudiced? How were they prejudiced? We put in evidence at trial through Mr. Ayers that they were not, and it was significant evidence. At that point in time, we have to look at the facts of the case and say, what is it that they were missing that has caused them prejudice so that they cannot adequately defend this claim at this time? And I think the answer from all of the facts in this particular case is they weren't prejudiced. American Family argues there might have been a couple few additional questions or several questions they would have asked. But the bottom line is what exactly would those questions have been? What evidence would they have caused to be produced that wouldn't have been able to be produced during the entire course of this litigation? And I think the answer to that is nothing. All the facts were in place. I think the message that the court would send is that each of the cases have to be determined based upon the facts. And if the facts in this case reach the level of showing that we have overcome the burden of showing non-prejudice to American Family, then I think given these particular facts, the court could explain it in that way.
Thank you, Ms. Roeder. Thank you, Ms. Wickstrom. That concludes 99-1069 hearing and our January oral.